Thank you, Roger. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to be here. I have the dubious pleasure of being the only soft condensed matter experimentalist who actually works at PI. That's kind of interesting. Of course, my research, as Roger said, is all done over at the University of Waterloo. And what I'm going to talk about now is kind of a fraction of a pretty small fraction of what we've done, but it involves this new technique, which for us is beta NMR. And in the first case, we looked at it to look at depth-dependent molecular dynamics in glassy films, and that was really along the lines of our main research area. But then we kind of stumbled upon the technique as a way of looking at a problem which had sat unsolved experimentally in polymer physics for over 20 years, and that is surface segregation in polymer blends. So the first thing I'll talk about is this first project. And really, this is the driving force behind this is not this laser pointer, but it's Ian McKenzie. Let's go with plan B. And here we go. Ian McKenzie, who is at Triumph, as well as Rob Kiefel and Andrew McFarland. And then my student, Chad Daly, has also been involved in all of the experiments. So these are the people that have been there and done the work. I've actually never seen the experiments once they left our lab and before I see the data. And so I'm going to have to give an outline. First of all, why do I care about doing this? Why would I bother trying to do beta NMR in glassy films? There's a whole other kind of story that's been going on in the last 15 or 20 years as to why people think this is interesting and why it's worth doing. And then I'll have to sum up what we think we know about the system already, what we think the dynamics and the surface of these glassy films is like. Is it different than we might expect? And then what kind of experiments are we going to do? What are we going to measure? And then what exactly are we measuring? What kind of dynamics are we measuring? And then we're going to have to go back in the end and compare what we learned from the experiment with what we thought we already knew from the years of previous experiments. And actually, the results are fairly surprising. So I didn't really know necessarily what my audience would be like. I know it's certainly not like the audience I have at APS when everybody's a polymer physicist. As a matter of fact, I expect I'm the only polymer physicist in the room. But the reason we've been looking at polymer films is, in particular, the polymers we use are great glass-forming systems. They just almost refuse to crystallize. And so they're really good for studying physics about the glass transition. And so in the glass transition I'm talking about is a structural glass transition, and the glasses I talk about are structural glasses rather than maybe the spin glasses you might be more familiar with. And if I look at some quantity that characterizes the relaxation, it often has this kind of Vogel-Fulcher type dependence there, where the relaxation times or anything that similar to a relaxation time, like a viscosity, like we show here, tends to apparently diverge at some temperature that's below, or some temperature which we call the Vogel temperature T naught. And so all glassy materials have dynamics which look like this. And in particular, polymers tend to be these fragile glasses where you have a very, very steep change in the dynamics. Things change, slow down many, many, many orders of magnitude over a small temperature range. And so what does that mean in terms of how we measure where it is? It's not always easy to measure, say, viscosities if I have a 10 nanometer thick film or things like that. So often what we do are dielectric measurements, and we look at what's a thermodynamic signature of a kinetic transition. So I imagine I have this liquid, and I start cooling it down. It has a certain thermal expansivity. And at some point, okay, let's say I'm able to go past the freezing temperature, so I supercool the liquid. And at some point, the dynamics become so slow that they can't respond on the time scale of my experiment, and I go into this glassy state. And the glassy state looks exactly like the liquid, only there's no motion. So it's very much a kinetic transition with almost no structural signature of what's happening. And another idea which has really kind of been enduring in the idea of dynamics in glassy materials is this idea of cooperative dynamics. And it's quite simply that if I'm at high temperatures, then any one unit or particle or entity can easily move around the other molecules or whatever we have. And then as it becomes, the temperature becomes lower, the density becomes higher, it becomes much more difficult to move. And at some point, essentially, it gets stuck between its neighbors and it gets caged in. And then as you lower the temperature or increase the density even more, in order to have any motion at all, the particles can't just move on their own and they have to undergo this kind of cooperative motion. And if I cool down even further, I need more and more particles to share in this cooperative motion. And this introduces this idea of a length scale or a cooperativity length. And this has been, you know, a 50-year-old idea in structural glasses, which really has never been observed, because there is absolutely, as far as we know, no structural manifestation of this dynamic quantity. Of course, people have done these things in colloidal glasses, and in those cases, you can actually see it. So in colloidal glasses, in the last 10 years, we've had kind of breakthroughs in that, but we never see this thing in real molecular glasses. But we expect it to have a length scale that's a few nanometers. Well, one of the things that people did then to try and look at that is, I say, if I take my glassy material and I put it in a small box, then if I have this length scale, once my box becomes the size or similar to this length scale, I should see kind of anomalous properties. And so, I guess almost, well, 20 years ago now, Richard Jones's group in Cambridge did these measurements looking at the glass transition temperature of thin polymer films. And what they found is that for films less than about 40 nanometers, these glass transition values they measured became lower than the bulk value. And the effects are actually very large. And as a matter of fact, you know, I don't have time to show any of these things, but if I showed some of the work that we've done on freestanding films, you can have reductions in the glass transition that are of the order of 100 degrees. And so one of the questions is, well then, why does this happen? And the first thing that comes to mind, and there's a number of experiments that's supporting this idea, is that it has a lot to do with the properties of the free surface. There's kind of an enhanced mobility, there's less restrictions on the motion at the free surface, so there's easier dynamics and faster dynamics at the free surface. And so you might want to look for this, and this has been something people have, again, been looking at it about for 15 years. We recently published something which is, I think, a very nice, simple way to do the experiment, which makes the interpretations fairly unambiguous. And basically what we do is we start with this kind of a step film. The step film just evolves due to capillary pressures, and it wants to smooth out. And if you're above the glass transition, it can smooth out by just flow in the whole film. If you're below the glass transition, the whole film can't flow, and instead you can look at the system where you just have flow over a surface. And it turns out if you solve the two fluid flow equations for those cases, they actually give very different profiles. And so you can easily and quantitatively tell when it goes from one system to the other. And that's what this is here. This correlation function tells you when you go from surface flow only on the surface to flow in the whole material. So it's a very sharp transition, and in this case here, the only way this system can evolve is through mobility or motion or flow rather in a very thin surface layer. And so then we can look at the properties of that. We can find its viscosity, but it's coupled to the size of the surface region. And this has been another then kind of problem. What's the size of the surface region? And this was maybe got a lot of kind of airplay when it was first suggested when Degen became interested in the problem, and his suggestion was that instead of looking at these single TG values, we should look at a distribution of TG. So look at the layer right near the surface and then the next layer and the next layer. That's a very hard thing to do. As a matter of fact, I don't think that's possible to do. And actually, for some reasons, I don't even think it's the right thing to do. So what do we think is going on in one of these films? Well, in most of the material, it's just bulk-like. Okay, that's what the definition of bulk is. Most of the material behaves that way. Now, somewhere near the free surface, we have a region where we expect there's a higher mobility. And then there's a length scale over which this higher mobility at the surface gradually changes into the bulk-like mobility. And it's reasonable, and there's a number of fairly recent papers suggesting that it has to be this way, that length scale is the same as the length scale for cooperative dynamics in bulk materials. And so then what we should be able to do is we should be able to measure, find experiments to measure the size of this layer, and it should tell us about this kind of elusive length scale for glass forming materials. And I show here some experiments where people have done that, and you see that the size of this layer in both cases increases as we increase the temperature. That's exactly the wrong temperature dependence we expect for this cooperative region. And then we've got to think about it a little bit. And while this correlation length is not necessarily the same size or the same thing as what you measure when you do one of these experiments. For instance, in the experiment I showed you with the flow on the step, this is actually a macroscopic flow process. And it's not necessarily clear how it relates to the microscopic dynamics. And in particular, you can come up with just a very, very simple argument where you can parameterize basically, we don't understand the glass transition at all, so we don't have to worry about having a theory for it. We know the surface is has an excess mobility, and at some point it becomes bulk-like, and this basically is all included in some function which we don't know anything about. All we know is that f of 0 is 1, and as f goes to infinity, that function has to go to 0. And what this means, though, is that if you ask a very simple question, how much of your sample is melt-like? How much of your sample has a rheological temperature, which describes the dynamics, which is above the glass transition? That's the size of a melt-like region. And this is what you measure in an experiment, a typical experiment. And this is the thing we want. And unfortunately, as the rest of the sample undergoes the glass transition, that totally dominates the effect. And so you just can't measure this thing here. And so that's really too bad, and this is kind of the starting point for trying to do these beta NMR experiments, is I want to know what this length scale is for the correlated dynamics. So when we start off, one of the things we should say, first of all, is what do we think we know? I've given the briefest of brief introductions on what we think we know about surfaces and glass transitions and thin films. Well, we think we know that the TG reductions are related to this enhanced surface mobility. Actually, we have a lot of good evidence for that. For example, if I take a freestanding film that's twice the thickness of a supported film, I actually get the exact same TG reduction. That suggests that there's just the volume fraction of surface region that's responsible for the effect. And actually, I can manipulate the free surfaces. I can cover them, I can remove the covering, and I can make the effect come and go. So there's very strong evidence for this first thing. The other thing we think we know is that we think that very fast dynamics aren't enhanced. So if I have a probe which is measuring, say, something in the megahertz or even kilohertz or even tens of hertz scale, I won't see any enhancement of dynamics. Okay, and there are other experiments that show this. And this is actually really important because it's a crucial step in rationalizing some outstanding contradictions which have shown up in the literature. So in some sense, this has to be true or everything's screwed up. The other thing is that we only see enhanced dynamics at temperatures very close to and below the glass transition temperature. And so if I take one of my films, I heat it all 20 degrees above the glass transition temperature, now it becomes dynamically homogeneous. The surface behaves exactly like every other part of the material. And the other thing we think we know is that the size of this liquid-like layer that we've looked at is actually not a direct measure of the dynamical correlation length that we would really like to have. And so this suggests the need for a true molecular-level localized measurement of the dynamics. And so we can pick out this layer and the layer underneath it and the layer underneath it rather than just say, well, how much of the free surface is behaving like a liquid? So to do this, this is the experiment that we're talking about. Basically, I should tell you, I realize that probably not many people even know what a polymer is. So now this is actually chemistry. This might be one of the first times chemistry has shown its face and perimeter, but this is a styrene unit. We use polystyrene, which is just many, many, many of these over and over. We use two different polymers. One of them has about 10 of these units, and one of them has, well, more, whatever that is divided by 100 is, because each monomer unit has a molecular weight of about 100. And of course, if I take the chains, really long chains look like this, and that actually explains a lot as to why they don't form crystals. They're very, very disordered chains. One of the things I should mention on the side is, because of this beta NMR experiment, because we had to use this very low molecular weight, and the reason for that is because they didn't have a heater, and we couldn't go near the glass transition, which is about 100 degrees Celsius. So instead, we had to use a different polymer, very low molecular weight, so the glass transition could essentially come to us. And in doing this, we've actually discovered three or four really cool things that have never been seen before, just because Triumph doesn't have a heater for us to use. So it's kind of a good lesson in serendipity for us. But basically what we do is we spin cast these films. So we just take them, we dissolve them in a solvent, we spin cast them. We can make very, very thin films if we want this way, very uniform, very smooth. For these experiments, they're not that thin, they're 180 nanometers. Of course, because we only want to look at the surface region, so we want them to be smooth, but we don't need them to be actually very thin at all. And then basically what we do is polarize the nuclei, and essentially you just do NMR, but it's a lot, I guess, more effective because you can polarize with orders and orders and orders of magnitude. I think it's 10 orders of magnitude better efficiency than you can do in a conventional NMR experiment. And so then what you're able to do is look at much smaller amounts of material. And then you can detect the polarization. These are radioactive nuclei, and so the asymmetry in the decay products tells you about the polarization of the nucleus. So it's actually, in some sense, an easier experiment to do. Now you can calculate the decay rate in terms of the physical parameters, and you can see that in the experiment we're doing, we're sensitive to the local fluctuations in the electric field at frequencies of about 10 to the 7 hertz. So actually, our experiment is a very high frequency measurement compared to some of the ones that I haven't talked about. So again, this is more or less just repeating the details of what I said, so I won't say it again. One of the nice things about using the lithium, though, is because what I can do is I can take the lithium ion, I give it some energy, it gets into my film, and then it deposits its energy and stops. Okay? And depending on what energy is, that tells you more or less where that lithium is implanted. And they're fairly sharply peaked, especially where we care about it, very, very near the surface. And so what I can do is I don't have to say I'm just looking at the entire layer near the top. I can actually look at buried layers underneath, and I can find out what the fluctuation of the electric field are at this frequency of about 10 to the 7 hertz. Okay, and so this is basically just to get an idea. The idea here was to look at and see if we believed that what we were measuring had anything to do with the relaxations that are typically associated with the glass transition. Materials have many, many, many types of relaxations. I mean, for instance, in a polymer, I could have, you know, these phenyl groups doing something. They can have some sort of motion. It's certainly dynamics, but that doesn't necessarily relate to, say, the viscosity, which is a very large-scale macroscopic relaxation. And so the things associated with the alpha relaxation are things then that are able to, say, relax stress. If I put a stress on a sample, it can relax over time by this alpha relaxation process. But there are many, many, many other processes and other types of motion that can't possibly relax stress. And so in doing this, what we can do is we can look at this and see when we get this onset of extra relaxation, and we can say, well, does this make sense according to that Vogel-Fulcher thing I showed very early on? I know what those parameters are for polystyrene, and I can say, does this temperature make sense for this material? And actually, it's pretty good. The glass transition you would get, the low frequency or dielectric glass transition, is about 280 Kelvin. We see an onset of relaxation just beyond 300. That's what we would expect looking at frequencies of tens of megahertz. So that was a very encouraging thing to go on. And then the other thing we've done is we've explored where might we expect the lithium to be. And there's a very, very deep energy minimum when it becomes trapped between two two phenyl rings. And so what we expect we're doing is looking at something related to the motion of these phenyl rings. But of course, we can't actually tell. All we see is a change in the relaxation rate. And so now what we can do is we can go on and we can look at different temperatures and different parts of the sample. And so we have two types of samples, like I mentioned. We have low molecular weight and high molecular weight. For the most part, it doesn't matter. I could have got rid of one of them, and it really wouldn't matter for our purposes. What we can tell from this is the things that are, once you get above some temperature, so at 200, there's actually very little difference between the surface and the bulk. There's actually very little relaxation. Once you get to these higher temperatures, you can see, of course, faster relaxation. The other thing you can see is that the surface is always faster than the bulk by a little bit. It's hard to quantify or to, based on this data alone. So what we can do instead is we can look at then the relaxation rate as a function, which is just fitting this, and we can look at that rate as a function of two things, as a function of the temperature and as a function of the depth we probe. So let's look at the temperature first. So again, now I'm just looking at what I call surface and what I call bulk. Surface has a depth of the 2.5 nanometers. This is a very, very close to the free surface. And bulk is 75 nanometers in, basically almost halfway through the film. And so what we can see that in all of these cases, we see an onset of relaxation somewhere around 200, which is actually surprising and a little bit puzzling because the alpha relaxation has nothing that far below bulk TG. There should be no relaxation. So this indicates that whatever we're seeing certainly has something which is a very local and non-cooperative character. The other measurement suggested at least some of it was related to this cooperative alpha relaxation, but not all of it. And so what we can do here now is we can look, I'll have to look at the next slide and see what is it I'm going to do, is we want to look then at these, at the relaxation rate then at any particular temperature, and then do this as a function of depth. And the reason we can do this is because, okay, so here's surface and bulk for one molecular weight. As I go from the surface deep into the sample, I'm going to hopefully continuously go from this one curve to the other curve. And this will define a length scale over which the dynamics goes from surface-like to bulk-like. And then I can do this at different temperatures, and I can get a temperature dependence of that length scale, because that's what I really want. And now I know it's microscopic, and I have an idea it might be related to this phenyl motion, and I'm hoping that somehow is related to the cooperative motion. So we have all the ingredients here. And now here is the depth dependence for different temperatures. And we can see that these are pretty well fit by exponentials. And so that allows us to find some length scale. And now we have a length scale at every single temperature. And we can do it for both molecular weights. And if we do that, this is what we get. And lo and behold, it behaves the same way as all this surface region. It has exactly the wrong temperature dependence. Certainly, we see that we have enhanced mobility. We have a correlation length for that, and it increases with the temperature. The other thing that's kind of puzzling about this is that we have enhanced dynamics far above the measured value of the glass transition. This is unexpected as well, and as far as we know, there are no other experiments where people see things like this. So on the surface, things look really great. We have enhanced mobility. It has a length scale. The length scale is temperature dependent. Unfortunately, there's a lot of things that don't mesh with what we thought we already knew. First of all, we have enhanced dynamics at very high frequencies. There are many other experiments looking at frequencies a lot lower than this that don't see evidence for enhanced dynamics. This is a very related question. We have enhanced dynamics at temperatures much above the glass transition. Again, there are no other experiments that see this. And this size of, it's not a liquid-like layer now, but the dynamic, the correlation length, the actual length that tells you how the dynamics go from surface-like to bulk-like, also has the wrong temperature dependence. And so there's two conclusions we can come to from this. One conclusion is that everything else that's been done in the last 20 years is wrong. Or the other conclusion is that this motion we see actually has nothing to do with the dynamics that are responsible for the glass transition, which isn't that surprising, but it certainly is disappointing. But you know, that's still interesting, but maybe we can also do something else with beta NMR, which is kind of neat. One of the things we know in polymer physics is that chain ends segregate to the surface. This is a purely entropic effect, and so it's fairly small. And so, you know, one example where the mean field theory calculation is done is here, but there are many, many other examples, and there are many experimental probes of this. But what you can ask is a similar question is, what happens if I then have two polymers of different size? So I have a small polymer and a really big polymer, and I blend them together. Well, if something is going to drive the chain ends to the surface, then you might expect that what it does is it makes the small chains go to the surface. And aside from being interesting, this is actually relevant from a practical scale, because if you change the amount of chain ends at the free surface, you can change things like the glass transition at the surface. You can change the friction. You can change the all sorts of properties like that. It turns out this is an extraordinarily difficult thing to measure. And there was a brief period in the 90s where people spent a lot of effort in it. But it was maybe the ability of these to kind of arrive at any conclusion is summed up good by Tom Russell, where he said the effect of deuteration, which is what they would do, they would deuterate it and then do neutron reflectivity. Effective deuteration on segregation makes the investigation of preferential segregation at the free surface due to the molecular weight impossible. The effect that you, the thing you do to measure it, is much bigger than the effect you're looking at. It's kind of like a quantum thing. Not really. But wait a minute, when we were doing this beta NMR, if we look at this plot here, there's something that we notice. If I look at the difference between high, there's a difference between high molecular weight and low molecular weight. There's a contrast. There's an experimental method that distinguishes between high molecular weight polymers and low molecular weight polymers. I don't really know why. Actually, I don't really care why either. Right, what I do know is that it exists, and I can use it as a tool for telling me where the low molecular weight and high molecular weight polymers are. Actually, we have a pretty good idea why. I'm not being honest there. And if we do this, here's an example of an experiment we did just on some kind of free time we stole on the instrument. And here's the low molecular weight. Here's the high molecular weight relaxation rate as a function of implantation depth. And here's a 50-50 mixture that's been well annealed, so it has time to evolve. And what I can see is near the free surface, this mixture looks just like the low molecular weight material, the small chains. But when I get out here, it actually looks like something like an average. And you can calculate approximately what you would get if they just contributed equally the volume fraction and the relaxation rate, just a simple linear addition. And what you would find is that the volume fraction of the small chains and large chains, well, there's a huge degree of segregation. So this is very promising. It's the first indication of this in the last 20 years or so, and we have the real experiment to do this in August. So we're kind of excited about putting that out there. Okay, so I'm at the conclusions before Roger just yanks me off the stage. We've used beta MR to do two things. First, we measure depth-dependent molecular dynamics. Certainly the first time that we've been able to do that. Unfortunately, it's not related to the cooperative alpha dynamics that we had hoped to be looking at. The other thing we've done is found a new experimental probe to measure surface segregation in blends of polymers which are chemically identical and differing only in the size of the chain. And so these are the first measurements of actual surface segregation. So with that, I'll stop, and maybe you have some questions.
Thank you, Jamie. Questions from the audience? Bruce?
So in magnetism, people sometimes worry that the muon is actually perturbing the system that they're studying. So could that be the case here too? It's a charged particle. You know, it didn't get transported inside. It had to find its way inside and deposit a lot of energy. Could it be perturbing the system so that it's different than it would be without the muon or the lithium, I guess?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I could do better than that. And this is always a problem. If I want to measure the response of the surface, there are two ways to do it. You either measure equilibrium fluctuations, which is almost impossible for this, or you give it a perturbation and you look at the response to the perturbation. And almost all experiments are of the second type. And then you have to start asking the questions when you compare the experiments, which perturbations are worse? And so, yeah, we can look at these things. If we were doing a lot of damage, we would expect to see time dependence, because damage is, of course, cumulative. And we don't see any of that. There are also, you know, there are some other checks in terms of we can measure, you know, we can look and measure glass transition. Actually, that didn't work out very well, but...
One of the things I was wondering is, are all polymers the same, or are some of them charged or polarized or polarizable? Because in the presence of a charge, you would expect them to be different.
Right? Yeah, I mean, polystyrene is nice in that sense. It has essentially, it doesn't really have a high polarizability. It has no dipole moment. It's pretty innocuous. Certainly there are charged polymers where we wouldn't feel comfortable doing this. Certainly there are polymers where you would be much more worried that they would interact with the lithium and have actual chemical reactions that go on. So polystyrene is the least affected by these things as far as we know.
Thanks. One more quick question maybe, Bhaskaran?
Even in the case of crystals, before melting occurs, surface is supposed to melt over a temperature range. Is there any connection or any similarity? They call it as pre-melting.
Yeah, it's a very similar thing. Of course, with crystals, I think what happens is it melts and then there's like a front, right? And this doesn't seem to behave that way. So in some ways, they're very much related, and that's not surprising because they must be related to the fact that the potentials that the units are in are different on the free surface. So they have to be related there. But then the way that kind of perturbation propagates through the rest of the sample, I think that's very different.
Okay, I think we should move on. Let's thank Jamie for a fantastic talk.